Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter, coming to you joyously and blessedly from the Good News Cruise 2026. This is an event that's co-sponsored by Corporate Travel and Ave Maria Radio. It's an annual event where we get to celebrate the joy of marriage and the family and to grow while on a season of vacation. Now, for this hour, we will start by talking with my friend Dr. Gregory Popchick, who is with me on this cruise. Children often need help with the basic skill of expressing their emotions. Dr. Greg Popchick frequently hears from parents, even parents of teenagers, whose children have anger issues that can explode out without warning. So what can you do in this situation? Well, Greg joins us to talk about this, to aid our children in properly expressing their emotions virtuously. Emotional regulation is the term. And knowing that at that age, it's not so much that they want to be that way. They, for want of a better expression, Greg tells us they're almost entirely limbic. Their reasons are growing. Their capacity for rationality is growing. But it's easy for them to default to a limbic, emotive expression. They're just big balls of emotion often. They rely on us. Loving touch, affirmation, firm hugs, and proper dialogue, meeting them where they're at, to help them redirect and to reset so that they can develop the virtuous conduct that we know they will need for virtuous societal flourishing. After that, we speak with Pete Barak. Pete has recently authored a book published by Ave Maria Press on fatherhood. And the truth is, many young men today long for direction and purpose. Fathers often feel the weight of that responsibility and wonder how best to guide their sons. At the core of these concerns is, what does it mean to be a godly man? Pete shares lessons on manhood that he learned from his own father. And then for the rest of the hour after that, the last segment, I want to talk to you about meeting God in the temple. In today's readings, we see Solomon standing with his hands outstretched to heaven, functioning as a kind of spiritual father over all of Israel. And this is pursuant to the conversation we will have with Pete. He gives Israel a blessing as spiritual father, but also a warning. And all of this pertains to how you and I ought to live as children of the Father in covenant today. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, February 10th. It's the Feast of St. Scholastica. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. The FBI is releasing four photos and a video of a masked armed suspect outside of Nancy Guthrie's home on the morning of her disappearance in southern Arizona. FBI Director Kash Patel says the subject, quote, appears to have tampered with a camera at Nancy Guthrie's front door. Minutes after the release, Today Show host Savannah Guthrie posting that her family believes that her 84-year-old mother is still alive. Guthrie was reported missing from her home on February 1st. The White House is 100% behind the SAVE Act. The legislation would require proof of citizenship to vote, and House Republicans are expected to bring it up for a vote this week.
It would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. It would require proof of identification, a photo identification before casting a ballot.
It faced an uphill battle in the Senate due to a 60-vote majority required for passage. House Republicans and President Trump have encouraged Senator Thune to get rid of the filibuster for passage. A full-year funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security is getting a thumbs up from Speaker Mike Johnson. During a news conference, Johnson said the House GOP leadership wants to see the Senate pass a full-year funding bill rather than a short-term or even long-term continuing resolution. Democrats say the White House remain at an impasse over proposed reforms to immigration enforcement, and DHS funding is set to expire after Friday. And the family of Jimmy Lai speaking out. Yesterday, the 78-year-old Catholic and pro-democracy proponent was sentenced to 20 years in prison on charges of national security violations in China. The family is saying the 20-year sentence is like a death sentence. From the Ave Maria Good News Cruise in Miami, I'm Steve Clark. Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Children often need help with the basic skill of expressing their emotions. Dr. Greg Popchak frequently hears from parents, even parents of teenagers, whose children have anger issues that can explode out without warning. What can you do in this situation? Greg joins us. Dr. Greg Popchak is the founder and director of CatholicCounselors.com. He and his bride, Lisa, also host More to Life, co-produced by Ave Maria Radio, Catholic Counselors, and EWTN. And it's a call-in advice program that airs weekdays at 10 a.m. And it's an outstanding program. They also produce the Catholic HOM app, an app that helps Catholic families thrive. Greg, thank you for joining us again. How are you?
I'm doing well. Marcus, thrilled to be here.
Always a joy to speak with you. I want to, and as usual, you are prophetic as well as pertinent. So let's talk about the fact that children have emotions that they don't quite know how to master in virtue and temper well. That's surprising to hear.
Well, I mean, you know, it's funny that you say that because it shouldn't be surprising, but it is, right? It catches us off guard. Right, you know, little Nutella Majesty has a temper tantrum, and you know, we're just like, oh my gosh, you know, how dare you? Where did this come from? Right, and so we think, well, we'll take away a privilege, or we'll take away the phone, or we'll let them do whatever, and that will fix it. Unfortunately, we have to remember that teaching good behavior and teaching emotional management, you know, are skills that have to be taught. You know, just like algebra. So, for example, you know, if your child was struggling with an algebra problem, you know, you wouldn't take away their phone to teach them algebra. You'd walk them through the algebra problem. Mm-hmm. And we forget that the same kinds of techniques that can be used to teach math and science and spelling are the same sorts of things that need to be done to teach our children how to behave better and how to express their emotions appropriately. So, for example, you mentioned the Catholic Home app, the Catholic HOM app, and there have been a couple of questions this week. We do a lot of coaching on there. Parents ask questions, and we kind of give some feedback and walk people through things. And we had several parents on Home this week talk about a 9-year-old in one case, a 13-year-old in another case, who were having these really violent reactions whenever they were frustrated. The 13-year-old was throwing himself on the floor and screaming. The 9-year-old was you know, yelling at everybody in the house and stomping off and slamming doors. And, you know, and the parents were wondering, well, what should I do about this? You know, and so I asked, well, what have you done so far? And they, well, in the one case, you know, they took away the phone. In the other case, they took away video games. And I said, but what have you done? I mean, that's fine. I get this attention. But what have you done to actually teach him what to do when he starts feeling that way? And they both said, you know, that's a great question. And so that's something that, you know, we really need to think about. How do we teach those virtues?
And so talking about teaching those virtues means disciplining them into the practice of those virtues, which means, as is true of the Catholic faith and parenting, there's this onus upon us to live that well that we may call it out in our children.
Well, sure. And that's really important part of parenting is making sure that we're modeling, right? We can't give what we don't have. And so if we're struggling with our own emotions, that's something to work on as well. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say that we have to have all of our emotional stuff together before we can teach our kids how to do it. It's something we can work on together. So, for example, one of the things I talked about on the Catholic Home app with these parents who were asking this question was what I call the wraparound technique. And what that really involves is not just correcting the child in the moment, but stepping back at a time when they're not engaged in that explosive behavior and saying something like, you know, I've really noticed that you have a hard time when you get frustrated with things and you really feel overwhelmed, and that can't feel good for you, and you know I don't like it. So I'd like to really focus on this for the next couple of weeks and just really helping you learn some better self-control, learn some temperance, and let's focus on that. So then step one is where you identify maybe two or three situations where the kid hasn't handled their frustration well in the last week. And you say, well, so first of all, tell me what stories were going through your head about that. Like when you lost the video game, you know, what was going through your mind? You know, when it happened. Oh, I was a loser. Oh, I'm never going to win anything. Or you know, whatever. You want to try to identify what were the stories that triggered the reaction, and then And then you want to look at that and say, well, okay, were those helpful thoughts or were those hurtful thoughts? You know, is there a helpful way to think about that? Well, I mean, I don't know. I can learn from my mistakes. I'm just giving some examples here. Right? So, but you're identifying what's a more helpful way to think about it. All right. Secondly, let's talk about how could you express that? How could you express that frustration in a way that isn't horrible and drives everybody away from you? Let's talk right. about that. And you identify, you know, what words could they use or what things could they do? Not, you know, not the silly kind of punch a pillow thing, but, you know, how could they express it appropriately to somebody that they're upset? Well, you could say, you know, I'm really frustrated about this, or I spent, you know, an hour trying to get to this stage and then all it went away and I forgot to save it and I'm really upset, you know, or whatever. But you're giving them the vocabulary to express it and even rehearsing it with them. Let's try that. Let's try it right now. Okay, so that's kind of the first part of it. So then what you're going to do then is every morning, maybe you have a little bit of a prayer time with your kid and you ask God for the grace to help them accept, you deal with frustration better. And then you say, let's think about the day. You know, what situations do you think might happen where you could get frustrated and really upset? So you're anticipating the problem.
Right.
If you could handle those things well, what would you want to do? What kind of helpful thoughts could you think about those situations? And what kinds of ways could you express, you know, your words or your behavior to, you know, to let people know that you needed help or you were frustrated? Let's think that through. And the point is, you're trying to mentally rehearse the day and make them aware of times when they might need these skills.
Right.
Then later on, when the situation happens, let's say, you know, and they get upset, you can prompt them. Hey, what did we talk about? I know you're really upset right now. That's okay. Everybody gets upset. What do we talk about when these situations happen? How could you deal with that? And then at the end of the day, you check in again. It's like, well, you know, let's talk about some things you handled really well. You know, I saw you getting frustrated with that, with your brother, and you handled that really well. And there was this other situation that you didn't handle quite so well. Let's talk about that. And these are all just like 5-minute check-ins. They don't have to be big, long lectures. In fact, they're better if they're not. But what you're doing is you're doing a wraparound, right, where you're making the child more aware and mindful of what they need to change. You're giving them the skills to do it and helping them anticipate the problems. You're prompting them in the moment, and then you're reviewing. And that's how we learn anything. Right?
Right.
That's how we would learn algebra. That's how we would learn to spell something. That's how we learn any other concepts. These good teaching practices help us learn good behavior, too.
Right. Now, Greg, as you've shared all of this, I realize that there's a certain onus and expectation of capacity of reasoning and dialogue on behalf of the child as you're trying to engage this. This is a little more difficult to do for those who have younger children. So, but a lot of the wisdom that you've shared is applicable just in a slightly different manner.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, so you know, with a younger child, say a child who is 6 or you know, 5 or 6 even, you know, you're going to need to give them more things, you know, as opposed to asking. You can ask the question, how could you handle that better? But then you're probably going to have to offer some ideas. But it's the same basic process where you propose some ideas, you have them role play it and practice it with you. Then in the moment, you remind them, hey, we talked about this. What did we say we could do? And then you kind of walk them through it. You know, it's a little bit more of you doing the heavy lifting, but it's the same exact process
right.
because it's how human beings learn anything.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on a wisdom that you had shared some time ago that we found to be of tremendous fruit. This whole notion of downloading calmness or the heart rate from it as with a lot of your counsel, it's almost miraculous if we didn't see it working so naturally.
Yes, and so what you're talking about there is the need to kind of help the child calm down in order for them to learn, right? So again, let's imagine the algebra. I had terrible math anxiety, right? So anytime I would have to sit down to learn to do a math problem, I would freak out, and I couldn't think, right? Well, kids, when they're learning how to handle their emotions, sometimes they're too wound up, too.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than us getting upset and lashing out at them, the best thing to do is to say, hey, come here, buddy. And we hold them close and let our heart rate slow their heart rate down, our breathing slow their breathing down, so they can calm down enough to learn and deal with it.
Greg, thank you so much. Always a blessing to be able to speak with you.
Thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure.
My guest, Dr. Greg Popchak, he and his bride Lisa host More to Life, and they're also the developers of the Catholic HOM app. Do download it. It's a tremendous resource for Catholic families. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
Whether you've been married 1 year or 50, this Valentine's weekend, step away together and rediscover what brought you together. Maryville Retreat Center in Holly invites married couples to a Married Couples Retreat, February 13th through the 15th, including Christ-centered reflection, heartfelt conversation, and a vow renewal ceremony. Space is limited. Visit their website at MarryvilleRetreatCenter.org or call 248-634-5566.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. We're coming to you from the Good News Cruise 2026. I am right now joined by Pete Burak. He is the author of a new book, A Man on Purpose. Pete is Vice President of Renewal Ministries. He is no stranger to this program, and this book answers that continuing need of feeding into the question of absent fathers and the need for fathers to rise up. Pete, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Good. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you here, and thank you for this book. Clearly, this is a compilation of stories based on the relationship you had with your father. I was never blessed to meet him, but everything I've heard about him tells me he was a saintly, stellar man. So you're very blessed to begin with. But secondarily, you've clearly carried these stories and lessons forward. So even before we get into the lessons proper, I wonder if you could just share from a very personal place how having a saintly father greatly shapes a direction for a young man's life.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the greatest gifts that can be given to any child, male or female, is to have a loving mother and a loving father that love the Lord, love them, and are willing to lay down their lives for them. And so my brother and I were absolutely blessed to have two parents who loved Jesus, who loved each other, and then who loved us as well. And in that order, I mean, they were very much disciples first, and then they were married and connected and united second, and then they were deeply invested in raising us and helping us grow, not only as just humans and in all the human formation that is required, but also the spiritual dimension. And, you know, when you're growing up, you don't necessarily you're not necessarily circumspect enough to know, like, mm-hmm. wow, this is a unique setting. Like, I don't remember being kind of conscious at different points when I was 10, 11, 12 years old of how, like, that I had a unique childhood. It just was the childhood I had. Now, looking back, I can see, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, I can see many, many, many instances of a very unique, very special, very intentional, very purposeful fatherhood that my dad lived in harmony with my mom. And so, no, I feel tremendously blessed. And it's one of the things that I felt, one of the reasons I felt like the Holy Spirit wanted me to write this book is because as I would share in different talks or in just different settings, things that my parents did with me, in particular my dad, to help me grow as a man of God, the reaction was always kind of like, wow, he did that? Like, where did that come from? And how did he come up with that? And wow, what a gift you had. Mm-hmm. And overhearing that over time, it became more and more clear that what he did in me should be more normative than it is.
Yes.
And it's not. And so there's a big problem. There's a crisis of masculinity in our culture right now. And I think much of that stems from a crisis of fatherhood.
I couldn't agree more. And so you're able to talk about what your father did for you and your brother, but now as a father of both daughters and sons, you're able to speak to carrying those lessons forward and seeing the fruit as it manifests in boys and girls. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could speak to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think what people will find in the book is that these principles are not necessarily, or rules as I call them, they're not earth-shattering in their originality. I don't think there'll be a lot that goes, oh, I've never thought of that before. You know, if you've thought about fatherhood at all or virtue, there's some of, most of this stuff is things that can be gleaned from just trying to be a good person and trying to follow the Lord and being a disciple and a faithful Catholic. But what I have found is a lot of times we overcomplicate things. I've talked to many fathers who just feel overwhelmed by, I don't know what to do, I don't know where to start. And so what I'm hoping to do in the book and these rules is just kind of simplify things. Let's get back to some basics. Let's get back to some universal principles that are not preferences. This is not play-acting masculinity. This is not kind of creating a caricature of fatherhood that I have to somehow rise to and almost lose myself in order to find this kind of idealized fatherhood that's more mythical than real. These are principles that I can integrate, and then in my own unique gifting and my own unique personality as the Lord has made me, with my own unique family, express it. For instance, like my family right now with my wife Kate, we have 5 children. Many people would probably look at us and think we're crazy because of the amount of sports that we play as a family. But we love sports, and both my wife and I played college athletics, and we spend a lot of time in gymnasiums. Mm-hmm. And some would look at that and say, that's maybe out of balance, or maybe why would you do that? Well, it's part of who we are. Mm-hmm. But part of what we've discerned is Team Burak is what we call our family. Team Burak thrives when we're active, when we're contributing, when we're in it together. And you'll see us, all 7 of us, trooping around to different games and practices. We're not spread out across the state in different places. We're together in the midst of that. That's a personal expression of a principle that we're together. We're unified but we're unified in action, and that we contribute to the world and to society.
Now, that even what you just shared, and based on reading your book, that's an expression of the unification of a family mission.
Right.
So you've got this concept of a core mission. You learned that from your father, but you've adopted it in your own life as well. A core mission that drives a family, which is the love of Christ. But then from there, there's a kind of family identity that develops. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think, well, every family is made up of humans, right? And every human has their own unique preferences and personalities and desires. And so part of what the project of being a disciple of Jesus is to submit everything to the Lord first, to say, in obedience, whatever my preferences, whatever my personality, all of it is yours first, Lord. And then as he helps us grow in holiness and grow in virtue, then he gives it back to us in different ways to express it in our particular vocations and state of life and even cultural place. Like we live in Ann Arbor, so we're big Michigan sports fans. That's a part of our identity as a family, is we root for Michigan. Is it as foundational as the fact that we are radically hospitable? No, like that's another foundational piece. We have a discerned understanding that part of the way the Lord has made our family is to be radically hospitable to people. So we have people in our house all the time because we feel like that's part of the way the Lord has uniquely commissioned us to build the kingdom through our family. And so much of this, and even as the name of the book implies, a man on purpose, there's an intentionality. There's a discerned intentionality of saying, okay, Lord, I'm not going to just kind of drift through my fatherhood. I'm not going to just drift as a family and kind of hope we figure it out. No, we're actually going to pray. We're going to listen. We're going to try. We're going to fail. We're going to learn from that failure. And we're going to keep moving forward, expecting that the Lord is going to guide us.
And so much of what your book talks about in terms of being a man on purpose is you've already alluded to this, the hierarchy of vocations, the hierarchy of callings, which is setting your priorities right. Just once again, in a very explicit way, just walk us through that.
Yeah, again, it was one of the greatest gifts my dad gave me was this very consistent, albeit not perfect, but consistent commitment to Jesus first and being a faithful disciple of Jesus Christ. My mom second. It was very clear that he loved her, and not only loved her, but liked her and enjoyed her. And they were best friends, and they invested in their relationship together. And then my brother and I were clearly next. And you know, in any given moment, you might look at behavior or different things and say, actually, it seems like you're overemphasizing the kids at this time. But there was always this sense and understanding that this is how he had framed his loves, his priorities. And then he loved many other things. He had friends, he had hobbies, he had passions, he had work. And those other things came somewhere following those top three. Now, at times, he had to go travel around the world because he was building a business. Mm-hmm. Did that mean that the business all of a sudden trumped his love for my brother and I? Or no, but he at different times, a man has to strategically say, okay, yeah, actually, for the good of my family, for the love of my family, there's going to be an emphasis on work in this time. But he always made it very clear. If there was an emphasis on work, when he got back, he wasn't going off and playing golf. He was playing with us in the basement. It was very clear that he was going to take my mom on a date when he got back. And there was always a resetting. There was always a re-proposing to us and a kind of confirming with us what really made him tick and what he was most passionate about. And that, again, is just such a important thing that shouldn't just be lived. It also needs to be communicated. Like the words he would use and how he would talk to my mom and talk about the Lord and talk about us also validated the behavior. So it wasn't just him living this way and hoping we noticed. It was him living this way and then also communicating about it.
There's a kind of deception in the modern culture that men ought to be the stoic, silent participants in the family. But not just based on your book, based on what you're saying right now, it's very clear the verbal aspect of the living out of the mission is how the mission and the vision of the family is cast with concreteness in the family, especially on behalf of the father. Share with us about that.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I wrote the book is there's just all sorts of caricatures of manhood that are problematic right now. I think there's probably two extremes, right? There's the vision of toxic masculinity, which would say that to be a man is to be bad. And then there's a vision on the other side that's kind of emerged of like an uber masculinity, that to be a man is only good all the time. And both extremes are problematic, and somewhere in the line all sorts of different caricatures arise. And part of the book is to try to present Jesus as the perfect man and allow ourselves to align with him through just the stories of what my dad did with my brother and I.
Talking with Pete Burak, he's Vice President of Renewal Ministries and author of A Man on Purpose, 10 Rules of Life from a Faithful Father. Continuing on the other side of the break, coming to you from the Good News Cruise. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming is brought to you in part by a gift from our day sponsor, World Marriage Day. Celebrate and honor your marriage with a fabulous dinner, music and dancing, and two dynamic speakers on Sunday, February 22nd from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. at Penas of Sterling in Sterling Heights. Give this gift to each other, a joy-filled evening to enrich your marriage. Register now at worldmarriageday.org.
If you have a message you want to share, be a day sponsor at 877-288-1077.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them, so you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Maybe you've been hearing a lot about the need to make a spiritual communion while participating from home in a live-streamed or broadcast Mass. There's more to it than reciting the act of spiritual communion. We should begin by having sincere repentance for our sins and affirming our belief that Christ's death redeemed us. Next, we call to mind the spiritual gifts found in Christ's sacrifice and thank God earnestly for them. Now we are disposed to pray the traditional prayer of spiritual communion. Jesus, I embrace you and unite myself wholly to you.
Sunday was always family day at the Denha house. My dad expected his seven daughters to be home for family dinner every Sunday. As we got older, nothing changed his expectations, not our friends or social life. We're made for relationship, for togetherness. That's why the COVID-19 lockdowns were so difficult. In the very first chapter of the Bible, God made it clear, it is not good that man should be alone. My dad would call each daughter and say, "Hey, I have seven daughters. How come I'm home alone?" We loved our father and we honored him, so we were home every Sunday. According to research, 18% of adults aged 65 and older in the U.S. live alone. 43% report feeling lonely on a regular basis. Between 10 and 43% of community-dwelling seniors are socially isolated. Family or not, if you know someone who's isolated from the world, reach out and communicate togetherness. This has been a Christ Center communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha Garmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. As a father who has helped homeschool my 10 children, I know the challenges you face. That's why you should check out Sylvan Learning Centers for personalized support tailored to your child's unique needs. Expert tutors in math, reading, and writing provide fun, interactive lessons with both in-person and online options that fit seamlessly into your homeschooling routine.
Visit sylvanlearning.com. Mention Dr. Ray for 10% off at participating centers.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Beat. I'm talking with Pete Burak. He is Vice President of Renewal Ministries, author of A Man on Purpose, 10 Rules of Life from a Faithful Father, published by Ave Maria Press. Now, Pete, to pick up where we had left off, for those who are just joining us for this segment, you had begun touching on how your book just speaks very honestly into the caricaturization of men and manhood in the culture. I know it's painting with broad strokes, but let's just pick up from there.
Yeah, and part of the inspiration for the book was just observing the many different narratives out there as to what it means to be a man, a lot of the confusion, and then rising up different voices and sources to kind of say, well, this is what it means to be a man, or this is how we should understand manhood. And as I said right before the break, there kind of emerged two different poles, two different extremes, one being that toxic masculinity, that to be a man is inherently bad, mm-hmm. and men have only done bad things throughout history. And I'm totally willing to acknowledge that men have done horrible things throughout mm-hmm. history. There is such a thing as a toxic man. Okay? Right. It's okay to acknowledge that. But the outcome of that whole perspective is this emasculinization of men, right? This kind of whittling down the man to something that is just so boring and safe as to not really have any impact or any real essence of masculinity left. And then the other extreme that rose up mainly in response to that is what we might call this like uber manhood.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of these YouTube influencers or others who have emerged that they're the epitome of physical fitness and they're pursuing wealth at all costs and they want as many sexual conquests without apology as possible. And so they're basically saying like all the inherent desires of manhood are good in and of themselves and should be pursued to their fullest degree. And both are problematic, right? And in the middle, you have Jesus, the perfect man, mm-hmm. the one who reveals to us what it looks like to be truly masculine, right? And so what I do in the book is not actually necessarily address that head on with deep sociological work. Marcus, there's not a single footnote in the book, right?
Yeah.
I didn't do any research, okay? I probably should have, but I didn't. It's just stories. It's just things that have actually happened in my life that mainly through my father, that helped me understand what it means to be a man of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what people will find in the book is that it's very accessible. Mm-hmm. It's not long. It's short. It's designed to just be this kind of narrative version of presenting a picture of what we can do for young men to help them become, or young boys become, men of God. And so whether it's the lack of a rite of passage in young boys' life, whether it's lack of other men other than their father who are investing in them, whether it's just the lack of understanding of how to win and lose and willing to take risks and pursue something with excellence, all those things are used to be kind of taken for granted in many places in society and have largely been lost. And in their place have arisen these problematic voices that I'm trying to confront with the book.
You've got a few vistas, if you will, or corner extremes of what young men are being bombarded with. In fact, even grown men are being bombarded with. So you've got, you've already touched on them. You've got your, you know, like Friedrich Nietzsche type, you know, the Ubermensch and I don't need God, but I can be the Superman. But you've also got your Homer Simpsons,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the caricature of the Midwestern dad, which is terrible. But you've also got the Andrew Tates now who are rising up in the manosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the complete absent dads. And all of these, there appeals to something that's going on in the masculinity of boys into men. And like you mentioned, that answer is in Christ. Can you speak to how all of these are just natural things that have been perverted and made sinful and extreme?
Yeah, and I'll take it even a step further. With the rise of things like pornography and gaming and gambling and substance abuse, what you combine everything you just said, these different caricatures, and then you provide all these different escapes, mm-hmm. and whether it's a substance or a virtual environment, where then all of it is designed really to enslave men and keep them basically operating as little boys. Because if you've spent any time with a little boy, what do you notice? They're very selfish. They're very self-absorbed.
Impulsive.
They're impulsive. They're foolish. You know, like I say in the book, like if you've spent any time with a high school boy, as soon as he comes home from a sports event, he's going to eat all the Doritos in the house, regardless of what it was for. He's going to eat the ice cream, even if there was a party tomorrow. He's not even going to think about those things, right? It's just this deeply self-absorbed, driven by passions reality. And it's okay to acknowledge, like, yeah, that's an immature boy. Again, that's why we need to form them. Mm-hmm. But a little boy who doesn't get out of that, who doesn't mature past that, who doesn't learn how to cultivate virtue that can then channel those passions and those desires into good and true and beautiful outcomes, who doesn't learn how to lay down their life for others and the joy and the freedom that comes from actually suppressing, not like in a bad way, but to actually have ownership, mastery in the spirit over, yes, I feel this desire for a woman that feels like lust, that is lustful. Well, actually, I can channel that to a good outcome as I pursue her in virtue and win her heart and marry her and then have children. You know, like that, the journey, the beautiful, wonderful journey of what masculinity can look like requires virtue, it requires challenge, and it requires examples. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest problems is masculinity really is something that is bestowed.
Yeah.
It's older men bestowing something on younger men, saying, this is what it means to be a man. This is what we're holding you to. We're going to make sure you do this, because in order to be part of our club, so to speak, this is what it requires. And almost every culture in human history had some sort of rite of passage moment where the men would look at the boys and say, if you go off into the woods and survive the night, you come back, you're a man. Or if you like so many different things that made it very clear that something has changed, something has been bestowed, and now you're held to a different standard. And in American culture in particular, we don't have that. We're a beautiful melting pot of cultures, but one of the problems of that melting pot is we've kind of lost a common understanding of what a rite of passage would look like. What do we have? Like, you get your driver's license? I mean, that doesn't really count.
21, you have your first
drink. You have your first drink or you vote? I don't know. But there's not a common understanding of, okay, something is now different. Mm-hmm. And now you're held by a new standard. And so when so many of the older men haven't had this model for them, then it is only going to trickle down and have problematic effects for younger men.
I couldn't agree more, and I want to ask you to dive into that deeper so that especially fathers listening, but also a lot of the mothers listening right now need to understand that on the one hand, you're right, these masculine virtues, the modeling of it, the rites of passage, need to be bestowed from a virtuous man to another. On the other hand, we also have to acknowledge that there's an intrinsic masculine genius within that boy that needs to be channeled, tempered, disciplined, and called out, and only a virtuous man can do that. And can you talk about that dynamic and why it's so crucial to have not just your father, but also other virtuous men to be set up as the village that calls that out in a boy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the analogy that works very well for this is, you know, if you have a big block of limestone or you know, and you're going to carve a statue, you're actually whittling away. You're carving out a lot. You're taking something away to get to the essence of what you're trying to, you know, produce as a sculptor. And I think that's a good way to look at these boys. The raw material is there. It's good, and it's worth chiseling and polishing and getting to that more finished product that you can say, oh wow, that's art, right? And what, again, one of the modern experiments, if you will, is this idea that the nuclear family is somehow sufficient for all of this to happen. We're a very isolated culture right now. Even just the way our cities are designed, our schools are designed, even our parishes are designed with cars and subdivisions and all these different things. There's a way at which you can really go through life as a family kind of as an island unto itself. Mm-hmm. Yes, you maybe go to the school and have sporting events, but there's not that intentional understanding that the adults of the community are collectively raising the children. It doesn't in any way diminish the responsibility of the father and mother as the principal and the primary educators of their children. That, we're not diminishing that. But what we're saying is actually to fill out and corroborate and actually enhance what they're doing in the home, it's super important. It's vitally important that there are other adult men and women who are validating, kind of co-signing on what's happening in the home. I mean, this is such a pivotal part of my story. I can think of anywhere between 20 and 40 men during my childhood who really cared about my spiritual life. You know, I go to Mr. Chalkley, Mr. Creston, Mr. Herbeck, Mr. Sauter, Mr. Rolfe. I go to their houses, and they weren't just concerned with, you know, how's basketball going. They really cared whether or not I was following Jesus. And they had conspired together. I didn't know this, but my dad had conspired with these other men to say, like, we need to raise our sons together. And so we went on retreats together, and we did all sorts of different things. And they had permission from my father to speak into my life. They had permission from my father to help form me in this common direction of virtuous manhood. And that communal aspect is vitally important. And you might be listening and you're saying, okay, yeah, that sounds great, but I don't have that. Well, to have it is to start to build it, to just decide, I'm going to look for other men and I'm going to be intentional and we're going to have conversations about this and we're not going to just let it drift, but we're going to do something about it.
My guest has been Pete Burak. He is Vice President of Renewal Ministries, and he's the author of A Man on Purpose, published by Ave Maria Press. And this is a brilliant book that anecdotally presents these crucial, life-changing lessons for purpose-filled fatherhood and manhood. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the following nonprofit, Christendom College.
Each summer, hundreds of high school juniors come to Christendom College for the best week ever. A week-long experience of classes in philosophy, literature, history, and theology, daily mass and adoration, activities like canoeing, debating, dancing, and bonfires in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Students leave with a deeper appreciation for the liberal arts and lasting friendships that stay with them long after the weekend ends. Learn more at thebestweekever.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here, inviting you to tune into Epiphany. We're made to praise God and celebrate our faith. I want to encourage listeners to connect, communicate, and collaborate with the faith community. Life is a journey, and along the way, we have those epiphany moments that bring us closer to Christ. Please partner with me and celebrate the diversity of our Catholic Church.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon, only on Ave Maria Radio.
How can we be sure our conscience is guiding us rightly? The Catholic Catechism states that in order to make correct moral judgments, we must have a well-formed conscience, one that is upright, truthful, and formulates its judgments according to reason and conforms them to the true good willed by the wisdom of the Creator. In order to avoid the trap of negative influences and the desire to prefer our own judgments, we must educate our conscience. The Catechism asserts that prudent education teaches virtue and guarantees freedom and engenders peace of heart. What are the ingredients of this educational stew? The Word of God, which we absorb through faith and prayer and an examination of conscience before the Lord's cross. Though our modern world sometimes makes discernment difficult, a well-formed conscience helps us see what is right and choose what is the will of God as expressed in divine law. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic. Consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I want to talk about some of the themes that show up in today's readings, because I think there's a lot that we can learn about as a people of faith. In today's readings, we see Solomon standing with his hands stretched out to heaven in prayer, and he's giving Israel an exhortation, a blessing, and a sentence. And it's easy to rush past too quickly because it sounds like pious prayer, but he's appealing to an historical reality that's crucial. So in 1 Kings 8, verse 23, Solomon says, "You keep your covenant of mercy with your servants who are faithful to you with their whole heart." And this text has to do with the dedication of the temple that Solomon has just built for the Lord. And it's exactly the renewal of Israel's covenant life. And it begins with God's character as a father in the covenant. In Hebrew covenant thought, all of history only ebbs forward because God binds himself by oath to his people. And so his people either live inside that bond or they drift into a kind of spiritual exile. And that's why Solomon frames the entire house, the temple. It's in cedar, it's in gold, it's in carved cherubim. It's a testimony to that Hebrew word berit, the Greek word diatheke in the New Testament. The covenant to divine mercy. The scriptures call that word chesed. It's steadfast loving kindness or covenantal love. But at the same time, Solomon immediately guards Israel from a very subtle trap that we need to pay attention to. And that's the temptation to treat sacred space as a place of divine containment. So I only have to be holy in a place that's consecrated to be sacred. As though the God of Israel, and so our God, could be housed in a way that the idols of the surrounding nations could be housed. And that's why Solomon cautions the people. 1 Kings 8:27. If the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain you, how much less this temple which I've built? Now, in a lot of ways, if you know your history, that line's an earthquake. In ancient Near East, temples functioned as the local address of a god. And so you look at the Near East and these buildings called ziggurats, they had stairs. They looked like giant pyramids and they had stairs. The belief was the god lived atop those stairs. And so you ascended into heaven to commune with that god. And so that was the point where that deity was fed, the offerings fed him. But his anger was also managed. And so his blessings were claimed through ritual. Israel's temple has some similarities externally. You know, it has an altar, it has a priesthood, it has sacrifices, it has a sanctuary, except that here's what's different. The sanctuary is all the imagery of a cosmic reality. But Solomon confesses the massive difference that separates Israel from every pagan architecture. God's presence is a benevolent gift. And he is still transcendent even over the temple, even outside of the temple. The temple is not a tool for managing and mastering God. It's not a stage for religious self-validation. It's a meeting point where the children of God get to commune with their Father, where the subjects of this covenant get to meet the King of Heaven, who chooses to place himself near so that his people can pray, they can repent, they can receive forgiveness, and they can renew the bond of family kinship that they have with God. And that's why Solomon repeats the verb listen. Time and time again, listen to the cry, heed the prayer, listen to the petitions, listen from your heavenly dwelling and grant pardon. Readers can often treat that repetition as a bit of poetic flourish, or we might even miss it entirely. But it's a legal appeal. Four times, Solomon is making a legal appeal. O God, hear us because we choose to hear you. Why? Because in the scriptures, the God who hears is the God who acts. In Exodus, he hears the groaning of the slaves he moves to deliver. In the Psalms, he hears the plea of the people, and so he remembers his oath. And so Solomon is doing the same thing. It's called covenant litigation. He's pleading the relationship. He's saying, in effect, my father, my king, you bound yourself to us, and now we claim the promises that you have promised. We come according to your terms, and we seek the mercy that renews our covenant with you. On your terms, not ours. And so you look at Psalm 84, And suddenly the interior dimension of what Solomon is doing is made public. My soul yearns and pines for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. It's so easy, even in music today, to sentimentalize that line. But in biblical anthropology, the lev, the heart, is not the seat of emotion. It referred to the inner seat and center of the entire person. Our intention, our memory, our desire, our moral choice, all came from the lev. If you want evidence, look at Deuteronomy 6:5 for this. And so the Psalms describe a human being whose entire interior life leans towards God, as if God was his home. The psalm includes the tenderness of the birds that build near the altar. Even the sparrow finds a home, the swallow a nest in which she puts her young, your altars. Why? Because it's an appeal to the tenderness of the heart of God itself. Israel singing this in a world where their survival depended on their borders, their walls, their armies. So the image of small creatures nesting near the altar, it's revelation of a much deeper truth. When their worship of God is alive, then the sanctuary becomes a place where they can be most vulnerable. They can breathe because God and his presence is their safety. And that's why the Psalms give a line that is an attack to our modern restlessness. I'd rather have one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. It's one of my favorite verses. I would rather have one day in your courts than 1,000 elsewhere. Many people will read that and think, okay, you know, that's poetic exaggeration. No, no, it's a diagnosis of where our hearts ought to want to be. We're not made for achievement. We're not made for worldly glory. We're made for communion with God. And whenever we see communion everywhere else, it's counterfeit. It leaves us hollow and thin and irritable and anxious and hungry and tired. And so Psalm 84 is a map for our souls, because it's telling us that the true measure of our life is proximity to God. And when we worship him, our entire desire is healed and reordered. Our memories are healed. Even our bodies feel safe because we get to long for what's eternal. That theme, ordering our desires, comes out in full flourish in the gospel. In Mark 7, Jesus is placed in direct conflict with a religious culture that had learned to be so orderly that the letter of the law was taking over the heart and spirit of the law. The Pharisees and the scribes, they observe that some disciples eat with, quote-unquote, unclean, unwashed hands. And then Mark, in his gospel, adds, all Jews keep certain washing, including purification of cups and jugs and kettles and beds. You have to understand, it's so easy to look at the Pharisees and cry, evil. Or the Sadducees and cry evil. But what we miss here is the historical context. The Israelites returned from exile and they knew that the exile was because they had been unfaithful to God. In Second Temple Judaism, these ritual purity practices were deliberately woven into daily life because they were fighting hard to guard Israel's identity, even against foreign Roman pagan pressure, because the last time they were unfaithful, they lost the entire nation. And worse, even after they regained the nation, they had not been their own nation for a long time. They had a little bit of respite under the Maccabean revolt and the Maccabean Empire, but it didn't last very long. And so you had the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, the Macedonians, and then for a while there, a little bit of respite, and now the Romans. They had the trauma of exile, the continuing reality of empire. And so they were desperate to be holy. And so what did they do? They intensified their boundaries. Food laws, Sabbath practices, washings. In fact, the Pharisaic tradition developed all of this into rabbinic literature. In fact, it's called the Netilat Yadayim, the washing of hands. It was a hedge around purity. For many of these, the practice was an expression of the sincerity of their hearts, except that they did it so much that they couldn't even see the coming of Jesus Christ, and that was the problem. But what Jesus does is he doesn't mock the ritual. He mocked making it theater. He was even saying that the gestures are meant to serve faithfulness to God. And so he quotes Isaiah, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. which means that the intent behind the action had been forgotten. The problem here is not the ritual itself, it's the distance of the heart. That was the breach of love. And that's why Jesus utilizes a specific example to prove that laws can sometimes forget the heart. For example, the law for Korban, dedicated to God. When someone declares themselves Korban, they've drawn near to God, and so they deliberately reject the care of their elderly parents. Mind you, this is in a world where claiming social security and social welfare did not exist. So parents who couldn't provide for themselves were left destitute. That law, the Korban law, was meant to bind a person's heart to God, not to deny one the onus and obligation to honor their father and mother. And that's what Jesus was condemning more than anything. And so when you look at Solomon asking God to listen and to grant pardon, Solomon knows, Jesus knows, the people will sin, but they will also return because our hearts are made for the courts of the Lord. And that's why there's a real personal call to this. Every one of us as believers, we need to learn sooner or later that our religious habits can become a hiding place if our whole beings are not given to God. So please run to God, run to Him and seek repentance and forgiveness. Learn how to live as children of the Father, because the prayers are important, the rituals are important, the liturgy is important, the practices, the disciplines are important. And all of these are meant to draw the heart closer to God, and all of these are meant to be driven by the heart that is drawn closer to God. And that is the cycle. That's why Solomon's temple theology is prophetic for us today, that the only worship that holds is a worship that costs our very being, that reforms our entire heart. In the fullness of revelation, it is the law of the Lord written on our human hearts that is where we ought to land, because these readings end by forcing us into a choice. Is God the center of our lives or not? And I say this for myself as much as I say this for you. Make the Lord our God the very center of everything we do in the faith, and watch the faith come alive in all the areas of our joys and our sufferings. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.